on there. In the meantime, a man being investigated after the collision that killed West Shore RCMP officer Sarah Beckett has been released from custody without charges. Michael Mulligan, how does that work?
Cases involving a serious motor vehicle accident can be complex ones to investigate. You would expect that in a case like this, a number of things would occur. You would expect that there will be an accident reconstruction report prepared. So you'd have an expert go out and do things like take measurements of the road surface, physically have a proper examination done of the vehicles to determine their mechanical fitness, whether that may have played a role in what happened. These sort of cases are also complicated because of the medical element to them. When you have a serious accident and individuals taken to the hospital for treatment, that can add a degree of complexity to an investigation. If, for example, the police were wanting to check and ensure that the sobriety of the driver, where you have somebody who's not hospitalized, that could be done readily by having them blow into a Datamaster breathalyzer machine to check that, to make sure the person is sober. Where, however, a person is incapacitated and taken to the hospital, that often becomes impossible. So at that point, if they want to test and make sure the person was sober, they would need to get blood samples and have those analyzed. And that can be done either by the police making a demand for blood samples to have them tested themselves, or the police could, if they had grounds, apply to get released blood samples the hospital may have taken for their own purposes and then have those tested. That process takes some time. It's not something that's done simply at the police station.
How long does that take?
It would take days or weeks, usually. So what may be going on at this point is you would expect work to be done to prepare the accident report in terms of the accident reconstruction. That will take some time. If there is some concern about the sobriety of the driver, you would expect there to be some time taken in order to have a proper analysis done. So the process would be, once all of that is complete, if at that point the police conclude that there is some basis to believe that a charge of some sort might be appropriate, they would send to Crown Counsel that accident reconstruction report, analysis of blood, witness statements, photographs, whatever they've collected. And it would be the task of Crown Counsel to review that to determine what, if any, charges would be appropriate. And the standard the Crown would apply at that point is, based on the evidence and material the police have forwarded, whether in their judgment there would be a substantial likelihood of conviction, and then whether it would be in the public interest to approve charges. So that's the process. Given that the police haven't recommended charges at this point, the reasonable conclusion would be they're taking time to have that sort of an analysis done and testing done before they send a report to Crown.
Is it possible that there won't be any charges?
That is possible. There are accidents that don't involve any criminal conduct or any violation of the Motor Vehicle Act. If, for example, there was a mechanical failure, the brakes failed on the vehicle and it caused the collision, or the accelerator pedal got stuck, there can be medical reasons for accidents. You could have somebody who suffers from a heart attack or a stroke or something of that sort, and there can be tragic accidents where there's simply no criminal liability.
Conversely, because the driver of the pickup truck has been released, it doesn't mean that charges are not forthcoming.
No, it would simply mean that at this point, the police don't have evidence which would be sufficient to support that, or in their view, more would be required in order for the Crown to do a proper assessment if charges should be approved. So that sort of measured approach is an appropriate one, and not surprising in cases like this, which can be complex.
All right, and we do know that Sarah is being flown for medical tests. That is the motorcade that will be leaving in just over 15 minutes from Victoria General Hospital. A sad journey to the Victoria Airport. We'll keep across that. Let's bring Henriette in. Good morning, Henriette. You're on CFAX.
Hello. I'd like to know, when there's an investigation, where do all the reports go?
That's a good question. In a case like this, there may be more than one inquiry being made. From the point of view of the police inquiry into whether there's a basis to recommend criminal charges or charges under the Motor Vehicle Act, they would gather all of the material and then they would forward that to Crown Counsel for the purpose of making that charge approval decision. There can, of course, be other things going on in parallel. You can have, for example, the insurance company doing an investigation on their own separately into things like insurance liability and sort of who's at fault for the accident. Sometimes when there's a criminal investigation, that may take a bit of a back seat, but there can be different things going on at the same time. There could be internal police investigations. There could be inquiries made by the police in terms of criminal charges. There can be insurance investigations. There can be a number of things going on at once. But the material as part of the criminal case would be gathered, if there is one, would be gathered by the police and forwarded to Crown Counsel.
So people should not be surprised that the driver of the pickup truck has been released by authorities?
No, that shouldn't be a surprise. I mean, it may be that there simply isn't evidence now to support the conclusion that the person committed any offense. It may be at this point that the evidence is unclear as to how the accident happened, whether it was caused by inadvertence or medical condition or mechanical failure, or there can be a host of things. There may be some inquiry into mentioned examination of the police officer. There may be some inquiry, did she have any medical condition or anything else that might have contributed to the accident? At this point, it's early days, so we should be happy they're doing a thorough investigation into it and not trying to leap to a conclusion about what happened at this point.
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about the decision by the BC Supreme Court that allows campers to stay at Tent City, and we're taking your calls. What do you think about that? We're with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson here on Legally Speaking.
Join the CFAX conversation on Facebook. Pamela McCaw on CFAX 1070. Everyone has an opinion.
He says on one hand it's a good deal, on the next comment he says it's not.
We've got the facts with news you can count on. If it's happening, it's here. Victoria's News Authority, CFAX 1070.
Collective Soul, the See Where You Started Tour, Saturday, April 16th, the Save on Foods Memorial Center. Collective Soul, with special guest Age of Electric, the unmistakable sound of Collective Soul. Reserve seats are on sale now at selectyourtickets.com. Select your tickets box office or charge by phone. Pick up the album, See Where You Started by Continuing. Out now.
Flintstones Masonry. Most homeowners would never risk having electrical work installed by a non-certified electrician. Don't risk a potential fire or poisonous gas seepage from your chimney or fireplace by hiring anyone other than a Red Sealed Mason. Flintstone Certified Masons restore every chimney to current BC Building Code standards. Visit us at flintstonesmasonry.com.
Do it once, do it right, Flintstones Masonry.
A shared passion for power, performance, and innovative techniques? That's Integrity Sales and Husqvarna. As a Husqvarna dealer, Integrity Sales carries all Husqvarna power equipment. From brush cutters, weed eaters, chainsaws, lawnmowers, lawn tractors, to a full line of parts and accessories. Count on Integrity Sales to keep you working efficiently with the power of Husqvarna. Integrity Sales, your Greater Victoria authorized Husqvarna dealer. 2180 Keating Cross Road, where the professionals shop.
What's that, boy? You want to meet the people that make your food, treats, and vitamins? Okay, let's go to Pets West.
During April, Pets West is hosting Meet the Makers. Come in and meet the fantastic people that make the incredible selection of local and Canadian-made products carried at Pets West. Go to petswest.ca or visit them on Facebook for more info, including a complete schedule of producers and daily sales. Pets West in Broadmead Village, committed to your pet and the community since 1989.
Drivers of Canada, Fountain Tires 4 for 3 sale is back. Until April 23rd, buy a set of 4 select Goodyear tires and you'll only pay for 3. Take your car, for example. You'll have a big decision to make. Which one will be that special 4th tire? Front left, front right, back right, or always a classic, back left? But as they say, with big sales come even bigger decisions.
Don't miss Fountain Tire's 4-for-3 sale on now till April 23rd.
What's with that echo?
Victoria Royals Black and Blue Playoff Hockey.
It's round two. Royals. Rockets. Tonight is game one at 7:05 at the Save-On Foods Memorial Center. Saturday night is game two.
The Victoria Royals are off to round two.
The playoffs are presented by Pepsi, Two Burly Men, The Home Handyman, and Gillis Plumbing.
Join the Royal March to the Memorial Cup. Get your tickets now at victoriaroyals.com.
If you're talking about it, they're on it. Saturday Morning Live with Mark Brenne at 6:30 on CFAX 1070. When you need to make sense of it, she has it covered. Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070.
Welcome back to Legally Speaking, everybody, with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson. Homeless camp remains in the lawn outside the downtown Victoria Courthouse. What do you think of this ruling, Michael Mulligan?
Well, we should remember what the ruling is. The ruling from Chief Justice Hinkson was not an assessment as to whether this encampment was a good idea, wise, good or poor public policy, or any of those things. What the justice was dealing with is what's referred to as an interim application, an application for an interim injunction, which means an order until the matter can be properly tried. And there's a trial date set in September. I think it's September 6th. And at the trial, you would have sort of all the sort of evidence you would have at a fulsome trial. You could have witnesses cross-examined. You could have evidence presented like you would at a trial. The interim application is an application designed to deal with, well, what are we going to do while we wait for the trial in September? That's what the judge was dealing with. And there's a test for that, and the standard test comes from a case called RGR McDonald, Inc. And the test in that case for an interim injunction like this, there are three things that have to be met. First of all, is there a fair question to be tried? Like, is there a meaningful issue at the trial? You don't want interim orders if the trial is just frivolous. If it's that part wasn't the problem. The issue here was the second two parts of the test that the judge has to consider when deciding whether to grant an interim order like this. The first part of it is whether the person asking for it would suffer what's called irreparable harm. And the final part of the question is whether the balance of convenience favors granting the injunction or not. Now, the province tried to argue that test didn't apply, but that argument didn't go anywhere. The judge applied this classic test for an injunction. Now, the reason the province was unsuccessful here is the judge concluded, first of all, they hadn't really established that there would be irreparable harm by allowing the campers to stay there. And the analysis seemed to be that, or it was in part, that while there was significant damage caused by the camping, there was affidavit evidence that the damage to fix this space would be cost between $300,000 and $350,000 mm-hmm. to clean up the mess.
Right.
The judge concluded in part, that's already happened, right? The judge concluded the fact remains that most of the damage alleged by the plaintiffs has already crystallized. It's been damaged. There won't be further damage or significant further damage by staying there. They've wrecked it. So, well, there'll be a cost to repair it. It's not getting worse by waiting till September. So that was in part why they didn't make it past the irreparable harm test.
Okay.
And then the balance of convenience. One thing to remember about these sort of applications is that they are very much discretionary. The judge has a fair bit of judgment, right, as to whether to grant them or not. You don't get one of these as of right. So the judge spends many pages of his judgment carefully considering the affidavit evidence from both sides, sorting out this issue of balance of convenience, sort of, well, who is going to be more inconvenienced if you don't make the order? What harm will flow between now and September to the province and other people affected versus if you make this order, what inconvenience would be suffered by the defendants, the people camping there? And on that part of the test, the judge found that overwhelmingly the balance of convenience test favored leaving the campers there. He looked at the evidence that was presented of things like feces in the area, people spotting rats, various other things, neighbors complaining about increased crime, syringes being located. But I guess it would be fair to say the judge was reasonably skeptical about whether those problems, which he accepted to be the case, were problems that resulted from the fact of the campers being there, the tent city, or whether those were problems which exist as a result of homelessness. And if you've got problems which are just the result of people being homeless or addicted to drugs or mentally ill and having nowhere to go, well then, you know, making an order that this tent city be dismantled.
It's not onto that site.
Yeah, you've just sort of distributed, and that's the other thing you pointed out, was that making that order might simply have the effect of distributing those legitimate problems and concerns, right? You know, crime or drug use or damage to things or interference with neighbors. The effect of it, making the order, may simply be to disperse those problems around the city so people are then sleeping in various parks around the city rather than all in one park. One of the things he said was, you know, that may just have the effect of shifting the burden of dealing with this legitimate problem of homelessness from the province, who's now dealing with it because this land is owned by the province, over to the city, who runs the various other parks and would have police going around waking people up in the morning and cleaning up, you know, needles and clothing and various things from different parks around the city and elsewhere.
Well, the city still polices it, though. I mean, if there's an incident there, it's Vic PD that's on the scene.
That's true. Vic PD does show up there, but you've got the province now doing some things. There's a cleaning company down there cleaning things up. You've got bathrooms being provided, porta-potties, this sort of thing. So he focused very much on the fact that many of the problems may simply be problems of homelessness, albeit concentrated in that area. And that's, I mean, that's the other side of this, right, is sort of the fairness argument, which isn't really part of the injunction application. But one of the bigger questions here is there are legitimate costs to homelessness in terms of both the people who are homeless, but also legitimate concerns from people who are residents and not homeless. And the effect of this camp is to concentrate many of those legitimate problems all in one place. So one of the political issues is the fairness of that, and then the underlying problem that may produce these things which are nuisances.
Let's bring some listeners in. Good morning, Deborah. You're on CFAX.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment off the subject, but I really think that the column that Mr. Mulligan wrote this morning in the Times Colonist was brilliant.
Thank you for that. Deborah, anything stand out for you in it?
Yeah, I think it was fair, Pamela. I know you and I might disagree on this subject, but he seemed to bring out the fair points more than some people have.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Deborah. Michael, okay. Your reaction.
Thank you very much for that. The column being referred to was a response to a comment written by two law professors from the University of Victoria commenting on the Gian Gomeshi verdict. The law professors wrote about that a couple of days ago, and they were extremely critical of the judge's decision. And they set out how, in their view, the judge was insensitive and how they thought that he didn't make a decision. He made an improper decision. In my view, and what I wrote about, was in my judgment that criticism of the judge mischaracterized what the judge's reasons were. And misquoted what he said in a fashion that I thought wasn't a fair one. One of the things that people should bear in mind if they're criticizing judicial decisions is that judges are prohibited by their role from responding to those sort of criticisms. Judges are expected to speak in their decisions, and that's it. So one of the things which I think is sort of incumbent on members of the bar when there's an unfair criticism of a judgment is to respond to that because otherwise it simply can't happen. And in my view, what the professors wrote, well, I think motivated by a desire to ensure that women who are legitimately victims of sexual assault and violence are treated fairly and with dignity. I think the way they approached it was to unfairly criticize the judge and misrepresent how the judge came to his decision. So that's why I thought it was important to write and clarify that.
We're lucky to have you on Legally Speaking. Michael, when it comes to Tent City, was the injunction not in part being sought after to limit the numbers, that more people showing up or putting up tents?
Well, the application would have shut down the, if granted, it would have required the camp to be shut down entirely. Now, one of the other things which was interesting reading the reasons for judgment is that the judge points out that one of the province's assertions was that they were there asking for this injunction because the police had chosen not to enforce the Trespass Act. And the province asserted that, and they gave the reasons stated by the province, said, because the scale of which the offense is being committed and the densely populated nature of the encampment, law enforcement officials have been unable or unwilling to exercise the power of arrest under Section 10 of the Trespass Act. Now, that's an interesting comment or submission by the province, because what the province is really saying here is, look, the police could have, without any injunction, just gone and arrested people for breaching the Trespass Act. But for whatever reason, they've chosen not to do that, which is why the province was in court making that application for an injunction.
Could they still use the Trespass Act and remove them?
I think they probably could. I mean, there would be an argument that, you know, there's now been some comment on the whether there's clarity that the people there are in breach of the Trespass Act. So you'd have to carefully look at what the judge said about that. But there's certainly an argument to be made that the police could still choose to arrest if, in their judgment, there were reasonable grounds to believe people were in violation of that provincial act.
There's an argument to be made that we need more time, but there's no one here to grant it to me. thank you very much. Fascinating as ever. Sorry we couldn't get to all the calls. Michael Muller.